Welcome to Native America Calling. From Studio 869 in Isleta Pueblo, I'm Tara Gatewood. During Women's History Month, we're highlighting prominent Native American women leaders who've made their mark on history. In this hour, we'll explore the legacies of Queen Liliuokalani, the last queen of the Hawaiian Kingdom, Willa Mankiller, the first female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, and the current groundbreaking female leadership at the Pueblo of Powake. Join our celebration of strong, history-making female leaders in Native America right after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native people across the country are gearing up to watch the Senate's final vote Monday on the nomination of Deb Haaland for Secretary of the Interior. Haaland, Laguna and Jemez Pueblo, is one of the first Native American women to serve in Congress. Holly Cook Macaro with Spirit Rock Consulting points to Haaland's record in Congress and her ability to connect with Native communities as benefits to lead the Interior Department.
Native women, as we all know, have been leading the way for a long time, and both in our communities and without. Her approach and her recognition as the highest ranking freshman in introducing and passing legislation in the 116th Congress, the last Congress, she passed more bills than anyone else in her class with bipartisan support. I think that reflects how we work in tribal communities. We don't consider singular views. We consider community impacts. We consider everyone that's affected. And I think that Congresswoman Haaland will bring that to the Interior, and she has a demonstrated track record of doing it as a member of the House.
Haaland is likely to be confirmed and will be the first Native American cabinet secretary. The Native Organizers Alliance is hosting a virtual watch party starting at 4:30 Eastern. A government official in Ontario, Canada, has apologized to an Indigenous provincial legislator who took the COVID-19 vaccine in a First Nation in an effort to promote vaccine acceptance. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, he accused the MPP of jumping the line to get the COVID-19 vaccine.
Premier Doug Ford phoned opposition member Saul Mamakwa on Friday afternoon and offered his apology. The conversation lasted about 90 seconds. Initially, Ford accused him of jumping ahead of the line in Mamakwa's home constituency to get the vaccine. But Mamakwa had been invited to the community of Muskrat Dam Falls by elders. It was to show others in the community who were hesitant about getting the vaccine. Mamakwa made no secret of getting the dose as part of an effort to convince Indigenous people to accept the coronavirus vaccines. Mamakwa says he accepted the apology from Ford.
He apologized for attacking me personally during question period. It's not me that he needs to apologize to, but it's, you know, Indigenous people across Ontario to undo the damage.
Mamakwa says Ford showed a lack of understanding of on-reserve Indigenous people. He also showed a lack of compassion and a lack of respect for Indigenous people. He also says Ford's response is an example of a colonialist attitude towards First Nations. Governments have made COVID-19 vaccinations for Indigenous people a priority, but Mamakwa says many of them are being missed because they live in cities. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The Southern Indian Ute Tribe in Colorado has found two cases of the UK COVID-19 variant on tribal lands, which are under investigation, according to a press release from the tribe. The tribe is working with health departments in the state on the investigation. In response to the variants, residents are being encouraged to get tested for COVID-19 at the Tribal Health Center. There are also COVID-19 vaccination appointments at the clinic and upcoming mass vaccination events. The reservation is under public health measures, including stay-at-home orders and mask requirements. The National Park Service determined a ranger who used a taser on a Native American man at Petroglyph National Monument in Albuquerque acted appropriately with policy and circumstances, KOB-TV reports. An investigation was conducted following the December 2020 incident involving Daryl House, who was tased after going off trail. House says he went off the trail to maintain social distancing and was there to pray. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support by the Sanosky Chambers Law Firm, championing tribal sovereignty and defending Native American rights since 1976, with offices in Washington, D.C., New Mexico, California, and Alaska.
Support by the Center for Indigenous Cancer Research at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, dedicated to cancer research, medicine, and cancer care for Indigenous population. A no-charge online risk assessment tool is available at roswellpark.org/assessme.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood, joining you live from my homelands, Ashirwit Dui. There are many women who are distinguished community leaders, trailblazers, and advocates who get stuff done. They're strong in the face of adversity and injustice, and nurturing and loving when it comes to preserving Native culture and making positive changes for their people. It's Women's History Month, and we are focusing on a few notable Indigenous female leaders this hour. One is Queen Liliuokalani, the last monarch of the Hawaiian Kingdom. The other is Wilma Mankiller, the first female principal chief of the Cherokee Nation, who was an important figure in developing the Cherokee Nation's self-governance. And we'll also take a contemporary look at Native female leadership at the Pueblo of Puake. And you can join us, too. Who are some of the Native females you look up to? Are there historical female leaders from your community who you feel deserve the spotlight? Now's your chance to let us know about them. Give us a call at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And today we are going to start off on the Big Island of Hawaii. In Mountain View is Kaiulani Mahuka, and she is the show. She is the host of the show Songs of Sovereignty, and she is a Hawaiian activist, and she is Kanaka Maoli. Our pleasure to have her here. Thank you for joining us for another Native America Calling. Kaiulani, thank you for joining us.
Aloha kakahiaka, and good morning to you from the island of Hawaii, where our volcano is busily creating more us, which we dearly need since it's being stolen, you know, all the time. Anyway, thanks for having me this morning. And it's one of my favorite topics, if not my favorite topic, is our Queen Liliuokalani. She was born on September 2nd and lived till September 2nd, 1838, and died in 1917 in November. She was the only queen regent and the last sovereign monarch of the Hawaiian Kingdom, succeeding her brother, David Kalākaua. And our rules of succession here in Hawaii are really complicated. They sort of follow the rules of succession comparable to the monarchy in England, as our monarchy later became after the monarchy in England, Britain. And so that's why we have the titles of king and queen and princess. It was once they started palling around with the Brits that, you know, our monarchy took this tone of like the British royals have. And she became queen after her brother died, David Kalākaua. And you might know him. He is the founder of the Merry Monarch. It's our biggest hula competition and festival that we have here in Hawaii every year. Hula had been outlawed by the missionaries and deemed depraved and, you know, demonic. And he brought our hula back and made it. It was funny, though. They called our hula demonic, but they liked it to entertain themselves. They called our language demonic, but we were allowed to sing our songs. So that's why we still have a language left. Queen Liliuokalani was overthrown in 1893, and she was pretty much just held at gunpoint and sent to her palace prison. And I mentioned our songs, how we were able to communicate. Our people were still able to communicate in the Hawaiian language, which by now the Westerners had learned, but they didn't understand the metaphorical, the kauna of our language. So you could be talking about someone and they wouldn't even know it. And an example of that is in the Hawaiian language, if you see a beautiful woman with her little girls, you say, "Look at that beautiful woman with her three little girls." In the Hawaiian language, when you say it, you would say, "Look at the flower and the flowering tree." So, you know, you would say in English, "Oh, look at that pretty lady and her kids." In Hawaiian, you say, "Look at that beautiful flowering tree." So that's why they outlawed the language, mainly because they just really couldn't understand it. And while she was locked in the prison, she got her news via flowers wrapped in newspapers. And later on, one of her dear friends and relatives created the song Kaulana Napua, which means famous are the flowers. And the flowers came to represent the people of Hawaii as they stood under her window day and night screaming and wailing as our kingdom had been overthrown. She was important because she advocated for nonviolence. She absolutely knew when they pointed the guns at her head and said, "Get off your throne," that they had warships. The U.S. military was stationed in the harbor, pointing their guns at the palace. And they essentially told her, "You either get off the throne or we're going to kill every last Hawaiian." So she did, under protest. And she really believed that the honest Americans, as she called them, would restore the kingdom. However, that did not happen. She actually went and wrote letters to Grover Cleveland, and he did a full investigation, and he found that the kingdom needed to be returned to Hawaii, and then he went out of power, and McKinley became president, and he pushed through annexation through joint resolution, which is illegal under the American Constitution. You cannot annex a foreign country without that country's willingness to be annexed. Calling it an annexation is just a bald-faced lie. We were overtaken by an act of war that the United States has never corrected. In 1993, President then Bill Clinton published Public Law 103-150, apologizing to the Hawaiian people for the illegal act of war committed upon Hawaii, although this bill was nothing more than an apology, because at the end there's a huge bunch of disclaimers that, you know, how they always do, right? They say, "Oh, you know, this doesn't mean you can come sue us for your land back or anything. This is just an apology." So he made that apology in 1993, 100 years after the overthrow. Today, we are facing being assimilated into the federal recognition program. They've been trying to do it for a long time to us. And although I understand that our Native American brothers and sisters have made do with federal recognition and some have actually prospered, for us, this is not a viable option. Number one, we're not Native Americans. We're from Hawaii. Number two, we're sovereign kingdom subjects of the still Hawaiian kingdom, which is currently illegally occupied by the USA. And on February 25th of 2018, Dr. Alfred Desaias published his findings at the UN Human Rights Council that Hawaii is under a strange form of occupation. So even the UN now acknowledges that we are illegally occupied, indeed not Native American tribes. We are still the owners of everything here, as you guys are being squatted upon. And it's been really interesting during this time of COVID to see what our people would do. I really thought that there would be more going on towards you know, maybe getting some of our crown lands back and everything. But we've been locked down pretty hard over here as well.
And we've been watching a lot of that. And Kaiulani, you know, when you talk about Queen Liliuokalani and you talk about illegal occupation, and I know there's a lot of people who can relate to that who are listening today, her words during the time calling out the U.S. government and just what it meant to make certain actions towards, you know, her community, her land, her legacy, and the kingdom, the Hawaiian kingdom. There was a lot of very important things that she said. And even to this day, I hear a lot of people who quote some of her speeches calling out this illegal activity, as she said. And for you, knowing that this strong monarch, this indigenous woman, this indigenous leader is a one who had to face this and goes down in history as the person, one of the last standing monarchs to stand up against foreign invading entities. For you, knowing that somebody so strong, so powerful is remembered today, you know, for you, what is the most important thing that you think we should be tributing to Queen Liliuokalani, things we really need to remember?
Well, she did make a journey. After they released her from prison, she traveled from San Francisco to the State Department in Washington, D.C. by horse and by train. And as she went, you have to realize this is a sovereign monarch, very educated. She spoke many languages. She wrote operas. And she was entertaining people in salons and bars, you know, as she made her way. She was singing to the Americans. And she called them the honest Americans. And she said, "Hear me." The most important thing she told the United States was, "Do not covet the little vineyard, Naboth, lest the curse of Ahab befall you, if not in your day, in that of your grandsons." And those words give me such goosebumps because we see what's happening in the United States today with all their families, with these ruling, you know, these elites and their families and what's going on. And her prophecy was so right on point. She traveled all the way to Washington, D.C., to file her letter of protest. And we did that in June of 2016, 119 years to the day. We went and refiled her letter of protest, which was actually never answered by the United States.
And that movement, it really caught the eyes of many. But do you think they were listening? And I want you to pick up from there right after the break. There's more ahead. Join us today. Phone lines are open.
Indigenous people are on the forefront of creating positive changes against the odds in Canada. From fishing rights to pipelines to improving social services, advocates are taking risks to improve life for all Indigenous people. We'll catch up on the major issues in Canada on the next Native America Calling.
You're listening to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood from Isleta Pueblo, and we're focusing on Indigenous female leaders today and taking a look at two historical Native leaders. We introduced you to the story of Queen Liliuokalani right before the break. We'll also hear about Wilma Mankiller this hour, and we'll talk with female leadership at the Pueblo of Powake. And we hope you'll join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And definitely we want to hear from you. Who are some of the Indigenous female leaders that you look up to? Tell us by dialing in 1-800-996-2848. And here with us today is the host of Songs of Sovereignty. We have on the line with us Kanaka Maoli, activists an educator, and we are learning the story about Queen Liliuokalani thanks to her. And Kaʻiulani is here with us, Kaʻiulani Mahuka. And Kaʻiulani, please continue. You were telling us more about Queen Liliuokalani. Go ahead and finish your thought.
Yes, and thank you again for having me this morning to talk about my favorite topic, Queen Liliuokalani. So we were saying, you know, she had been imprisoned and all of her lands and all of her wealth stripped from her. She was later released from prison and traveled to the United States addressing who she called the honest Americans. And your question before the break was if you thought that these honest Americans were really listening to her. And I can't imagine the racism that she faced. She was very dark-skinned. I do recall seeing the Washington Post's caricatures of her. They called her a monkey and pictured her as a monkey with a gown and a crown on. And so the answer is no, probably hardly any honest Americans listened to her, but she actually believed there were honest Americans, and I do believe that today there are many honest Americans with their eyes on Hawaii that know the truth of our occupation and know what's happening here. So, no, she was not treated well by the Americans because of her appearance. And later in her life, in 1909, she filed a lawsuit against the United States to try and get her kingdom back. And they decided that none of the crown lands specifically belonged to any monarch, and which is ridiculous. They're called crown lands because they belong to the monarch. So, and this had already been all mapped out on paper. And they said, no, you have no claim. At the end of her life, she was never successful, more than a decade of legal pursuits. And she was finally, in 1911, after being overthrown in 1893, granted a lifetime pension of $1,250 a month by the generous plantation owners and the territory of Hawaii. $1,250 a month, she got to live on out of her own kingdom coffers, and at the time, the Hawaiian kingdom was the richest nation on the planet. It was part of the family of nations, the precursor to the United Nations, the first non-European nation admitted to the family of nations. It was an established monarchy, and she ended up getting $1,250 a month for the rest of her life. And I can only imagine what that felt like as we made the journey across to go to Washington, D.C. I can't imagine just being stripped of everything like that and then going and singing for your dinner just to get over there and try and get your country back. I mean, what an amazing woman she was. She wrote many songs that what we have something in our language, and I know you guys do too, and I don't know the term, but it's called kauna. So it's like the metaphor, the meaning beneath the meaning. And again, the only reason why Hawaiians were even allowed to speak the Hawaiian language was because they wanted us to entertain them. I went to a private school where I was taught how to be an entertainer and a waiter, Kamehameha schools. We all learned to sing and we all learned how to wait tables. So this is the mindset of these conquerors, that the Hawaiians are going to become the military, they're going to become the waiters and the entertainers, and that's exactly what we've become today. And the last thing I wanted to say about Liliuokalani, she has many, many wonderful songs, and I know you've heard of her song Aloha Oi, which has been romanticized and called a love song. This is her song to the people saying goodbye. And if you really know what it means, I was like, I can hardly listen to it without crying because it's just a really poignant song. And she always says, until we meet again, at the end of the song, until we meet again. And I feel like at that point in her life, she really knew that it was going to take so much more than she ever thought to restore our kingdom and our nation. She did do a speech in the end, and she says, she said this. She said, if one man knows the truth, he will tell another, and he will tell another, and on and on and on, and our nation will rise and become the nation they once were, the Hawaiian nation. And that's why we're fighting against recognition, because we still have a fighting chance to stay out from that. It would effectively seal the federal government and the state government's control over all of our lands, our waters. It would give them the sovereignty of the land instead of us having it. Right now, we're cut off. We, you know, on my island of Kauai, we moved to the Big Island because our island is so overcome by visitors. If you imagine a football huddle, it's about 8 to 10 guys, and you standing in the middle and you only move around like that, that's how it is for us on our islands when the visitors are here. And it was just getting smaller and smaller, and so we came to the Big Island because here in this town that we live, it's a working man's town. It is not visitor-based. So a Joe Blow has chance of, you know, farming and making a living here, whereas on the island of Kauai, houses are going for over $1 million, just even broken down, dilapidated houses, because the government is encouraging everyone come here and work remotely, oh, and spaceport and military. So we were pushed off of our island, along with a lot of other Kauai people who are here on the Big Island. Mm-hmm. And it's funny being from one island and going to another, but the sovereignty of our aina is the main thing that she said, the land, the people, and the crown are one thing.
And that sovereignty, is really important. And, you know, just hearing what happens generations later, and just even talking about if we keep the understanding of the truth alive, how that will continue to grow. And I think that is something that anytime I'm hearing about Indigenous leaders of talking about how things can prosper and how we can continue to keep all of these things moving and in motion if we care, if we participate. And I'm hearing a lot of that from you today too, and Kailani, even your passion for even educating people about the reality of what is happening to Indigenous people there in Hawaii, and how even just having to move location to be able to feel that you can breathe or even be able to make a living. And I know another big issue that comes with communities there, too, is talking about the commercialization of culture and, you know, being, you know, Hawaii being seen as the mega vacation destination. And a lot of times the things you are saying, especially the hardships, are glossed over or aren't being highlighted. And so it is this conversation we're having today that started with asking, who is Queen Liliuokalani? And a lot of times when we start asking those questions about these Indigenous women who led our communities, either through title of maybe being the leader or lead role, but also the leaders of our community who made sure that culture kept going, who made sure language continued to be spoken, or even encouraging those in their family to make their nation stronger. And so we hope this has opened up a lot for you today, just asking those questions. Who are the people? Who are the Native women, the Indigenous leaders that we have had over time who have brought us to where we are today? We're asking you to also share some of that with us by dialing in. 1-800-996-2848 is the number. And Kaiulani, I'm going to have to go back and listen to some of those songs again after being educated more on this. And what a celebration, too, that a lot of this has been passed down through music, because we know how strong it is. We know it's a foundation. And, you know, we're going to continue to learn here about all of these people that we have invited today on. And we're also inviting you into the conversation. And so with that, I'm going to take a call. We have Melvin, who dialed in today out of Santee, Nebraska, listening in on KZYK. Melvin, you heard a great story. What would you like to add?
Yes, that it was great to hear about the Hawaiians. We had a Hawaiian doctor here who helped educate us somewhat on Hawaiians. But I was motivated by sisters. One was named Theodora Means. She was a feather, her maiden name, and her sister. And Faith, Travesty. They were both from the Yankton Reservation. And they got us motivated down here in Sioux City and around Santee here in learning not only the language history, but treaty rights. And I got involved in that in 1971, where she sent us off to meet with some treaty people, to a bunch of us young guys, four of us, to learn treaty rights and study under this guy, Mr. Lowdog at the time. But these two women, children, were influential in Indian country too. Russell, Bill, Ted, and Madonna, Thunderhawk, and all these people that were influenced by these sisters. They're my heroes.
And Melvin, man, a lot of energy going on there, too. And it sounds like your dogs have something to say, too. I'm glad you called in. Good to hear your voice. Was thinking about you. Remember the last time you called in. Glad to hear you're doing well. Thank you for giving us a ring. Thank you for sharing that. And there you go. More Native women to add to maybe your list of understanding more about, of paying tribute to. Join us too by calling in 1-800-996-2848 is the number. If you'd like to talk directly with Kaiulani Mahuka, she's on the line the full hour. And Kaiulani, we're going to make some room to hear about another Indigenous leader to help us do that. We're going to go to Little Rock, Arkansas. On the line with us is Kimberly Teehee. She is the Director of Government Relations for the Cherokee Nation and the Cherokee Nation Delegate to the U.S. House of Representatives. And she is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Kimberly, thank you for joining us for another Native America Calling.
Thank you for having me.
And so, Kimberly, hearing about Queen Liliuokalani, I wonder how many times you were thinking about the parallels, Wilma Mankiller, and the things she did for her nation. Go ahead. Any initial thoughts of just thinking of making space for these important Indigenous women?
Well, the first thing I think of is the legacy that women have had in our various Indigenous cultures. And from the Native Hawaiians and through, you know, my own interactions with Wilma Mankiller, she has, a very diverse, interesting history. And this is somebody who, at an early age, as part of, federal relocation policies, her family were uprooted out of Oklahoma, and she grew up in San Francisco. This is the, civil rights era where she learned how to be a, activist. Her advocacy included occupying Alcatraz Island in the late 60s, and she worked for Indian Center. She helped tribes protect their rights, learning early on how to advocate, how to overcome barriers, and had success doing that. She brought that advocacy back to Oklahoma. We know some of the failures of relocation policies is the lack of appreciation for how Native people feel about their communities that they're from. And so she moved back to Oklahoma and worked for Cherokee Nation. She became a community organizer. That's what she knew. She knew how to bring communities together. She knew how to figure out what the needs were and to try to get things done. She, I guess, became nationally known because of a project she undertook that became known as the Bell Community Project, where she received federal dollars for supplies after the P people of the Bell community told her they needed running water. And through sweat equity or through self-help, they, you know, they provided the labor for that. And, you know, and there are kind of, you know, stories about her at that time because, you know, being, you know, a Native woman going into these communities that are where Cherokee language is still today spoken and trying to communicate that you're there to help, you know, required the assistance of others. So she brought people in her her husband. That's how she, you know, she met him is through her community activism for the Cherokee Nation. He worked for the Cherokee Nation and he could talk Cherokee. And he, I recall, used to tell stories about how bossy she was, you know, but she had a good, she came from a good place of wanting to help. And, you know, that particular project won national attention. I think it got the attention of the news, of politicians, of federal politicians. It also got the attention of the chief of the Cherokee Nation, who asked her to run as his deputy. And, you know, and that's Ross Swimmer. In the 80s, when he was tapped to be the assistant secretary for Indian Affairs for President Reagan, you know, she filled his seat and then won her first reelection in 1987 at a time when Cherokee Nation still did not have women leaders in its government, not at that level. And she, you know, faced, she would say she faced sexism. She faced things that she that she wasn't used to facing. But nevertheless, she won her seat as principal chief and served.
And you know, Kimberly, just her sitting in that role, I really want to pause on that because it did catch the eye of many people, maybe even you. Tell us about it by dialing in. Phone lines, they're open. Hang.
Did you know COVID financial relief in the form of forgivable PPP loans is available to small business owners and independent contractors, including artists? DreamSpring has worked with New Mexicans looking to open or expand their business for over 25 years, and now they're helping provide PPP loans. Information, including how to qualify, at dreamspring.org. That's dreamspring.org. DreamSpring supports this program.
Thank you for tuning in to Native America Calling. I'm Tara Gatewood. It's Women's History Month, and we are talking about Indigenous female leaders who've made a mark in their Indigenous communities. And who are some of the female Indigenous leaders you look up to? There's still time to join our conversation. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. And just before the break, we introduced you to Kimberly Teehee, who's on the line with us telling us more about Wimmemount Killer, somebody that we definitely have learned a lot on this program over the years. And Kimberly, I turn back to you and the impact that Wilma made on the Cherokee Nation. I think that one's a huge one too, and I would like you to talk a little bit about what it means or how many times Wilma's name comes up when we talk about sovereignty or when conversations about leadership come into play, even there in the Cherokee Nation. Anything you can tell me?
Sure. So, I mean, keep in mind that, you know, she was such a strong advocate for social justice, for women's rights, Native people's rights, people of color's rights, and equity. Those were all the things that she brought as an activist from California back to Cherokee Nation. And that community organizing, the notion of self-help for the Bell community to provide the labor for running water, those are all things that influenced her as a leader of the nation. I mean, she believe wholeheartedly in the betterment of the community. She saw an interconnectedness with trying to address poverty and trying to address unemployment and such directly connected to the community, that we couldn't move forward as a nation in providing for economic growth unless we dealt with the community health, which meant providing health care and making sure that health care was accessible to the citizens on our reservation, providing housing, providing jobs, education, water, the infrastructure. She saw this interconnectedness that existed, that, you know, was part, you know, Cherokee people as a culture, but also part of just community planning, that you have to address the community needs of the nation first. And so that heavily influenced her. The other piece, I guess, that was very influential was during this time that she was a leader and becoming nationally known, you know, and having friends such as Gloria Steinem, Alice Walker, politicians. You know, she worked in different presidential administrations, Republican and Democrat. Keep in mind, she worked with Ross Swimmer, who was a Republican, and she was, you know, a yellow dog Democrat. And, you know, and they serve as an example that we can still look today on how people of different parties can work together and collaborate, that bipartisanship, and also a lesson in civil discourse, how you can move forward in working with different administrations. She also had great friendships with that she earned over time with, you know, the late Senator Inouye and his staff. She brought these people to Cherokee Nation. I was her intern, and in the 90s, early 90s, when she was principal chief, so probably at the height of her fame. And I was there as part of a summer youth program, and had witnessed all of that she had to offer. And it was a sight to see, you know. And you know what people don't recognize, because we know the legacy. But who was the person? You know, she had a great sense of humor. You know, she was humble. She was reserved, but she was so strong. I kind of like to call it, she was a quiet lion, you know, because she also just did not give up. And she was very forward-thinking. She was not somebody who looked at problems as necessarily an obstacle, you know, to forward thinking and to planning ahead. You know, she liked to think ahead, you know, 10 steps beyond what she was doing presently. And she'd like to, if she saw problems in the way, rather than identify the problem, you know, let's identify the solution. So she was always seeking solutions to obstacles and trying to find a way to break down barriers. And so she was very focused on that. She was very focused on community. And that's what, you know, resonated with me. She was also very focused on lifting up young people, empowering young women, especially, you know, by imparting her knowledge and through observation, frankly. I mean, as an intern, you know, I was a very junior staffer, and she gave me research projects. And she spent time with me. I got to write for her, and she had horrific writing, penmanship. But she would take the time to edit my documents and then set me down and explain to me, you know, why she provided the edits she did. But she wouldn't rewrite it for me. I would then go back and rewrite. This is when we had just good old-fashioned typewriters and stuff. And, you know, I always remember how busy she was, but yet I never felt like I was in the way. I never felt like I was unimportant. But you know, she was showing me how to be an advocate. And every time I did these work projects with her, I got invited to some meetings, you know, with dignitaries, you know, members of Congress, you know, tribal counselors, elders, you know, just whatever the issues were going on in the state legislature as well. You know, I got to participate in these meetings. I got to help, you know, write some of these documents. But these were lessons that she was showing me, because she found in me something I didn't know what I had, which was just I had a desire to learn, and I had a desire to help, and to help in a way that, you know, was a service to our people. And so, sure, I was becoming a public servant without knowing.
Mm-hmm. I hear it in your voice today. And just even thinking of your own personal story, I think, you know, we could sit here too and go over some of the things that you have brought to our tribal nations, and just hearing where some of your inspiration comes from, and being mentored by somebody that you knew really cared about what was going to happen to you as you continued on your path. And a true leader is what I'm hearing you tell me that Wilma Mankiller was, even beyond a title. And I think there are many people that we can relate to who are like that, who in our Native communities were the ones who empowered us, who mentored us, who made sure that we understood or taught us with kindness, and just even being able to recall some of the things that these people have brought to our lives. That's something that we get to do on a regular basis for different reasons. And because it is Women's History Month, that's why we're focusing in on Indigenous women who have made an impact on the history of our lives as individuals, as families, as communities. And so with that, Kimberly, I know there's a lot that the nation is very stronger for because of the work that she did. And I really appreciate you giving us some of this kind of insight. And, you know, we only have an hour together, and boy, it is going by really fast today, as it does many times. And thinking of all the leaders that we could be spending time on today, you know, I think I'm inspired that I can't even imagine how much time it would take to do that. And that just tells me the richness of our communities is really full. You know, we are strong. And a lot of it is because a lot of these people we're thinking of right now with these questions I've been asking, with these stories you've been hearing here too. And Kimberly, thank you for our look at Wilma Mankiller. And also here too with us on the line out of Powake, New Mexico, is Janelle Roy Ball. She is the governor of the Pueblo of Powake. My pleasure to have her here. An honor to meet you for the first time. Governor Roy Ball, welcome to Native America Calling.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And Governor Roy Ball, you are making history, and perhaps you are going to be the person that somebody's on these airwaves again years from now talking about someone who inspired them, you know, especially talking about women's history. And so for you, you're in a big position making history. Is there anything you would like to share about what it means to be in this position, to maybe walking on the lines, or, you know, step by step with Queen Liliuokalani, Wilma Mankiller? Anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, it's, you know, I'm honored to have this role for my pueblo. I was lieutenant governor for 6 years prior to this, and there was only one other lieutenant governor in New Mexico. You know, there's 19 pueblos in New Mexico, and I can say definitely in the 6 years I was lieutenant, there wasn't a female governor. So it's, you know, it's been a long, long time waiting. I think, you know, there's, I guess, always that stereotype of, you know, men are the, you know, assertive, dominant type, and we're more nurturers and, you know, supportive. And I just think that people need to realize, or men, I guess, need to realize that we're just as strong as anyone out there. And I think that's what's motivated me to do what I've done since a young age, and participating in my pueblo and being active in our traditional doings, and, you know, working my way up to the position I am now, because it's been, you know, it hasn't been easy, obviously. And I think that I'm here to support more women and just encourage our women to, I don't want to say fight, but to push their way forward, to do what they need to do to make a name for themselves and show people how strong they are. Because, you know, I come from a tribe that is, you know, more than probably 60% female. And it's, you know, it's, You struggle. I mean, I've seen the hardship that our women have faced, and lately I think that we're pushing forward. And, you know, we've had two female governors in our state, you know, the state of New Mexico, and now having a female vice president, I think that's just awesome. And and I hope it continues, because I think that you know, us women have a lot to offer. And aside from, you know, being the women at home, raising our children, you know, being the cook, we can get educated, we can fight for what's right for our people, and we can continue growing our pueblos as well, and just having the same authority that anyone else would in making, you know, everything possible moving forward for our younger generation, you know.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of that younger generation, what are your thoughts when young Indigenous women see leaders like yourself in these positions? What do you think changes for them?
I think it inspires them. I'm hopeful that it would. You know, I think that there may be more women than I'd like to see that feel held back or feel that they're limited. And so I would hope it inspires them to see what they can accomplish and what they could bring forward for their pueblo or for their, you know, community. Because here where I live, we have several non-tribal community as well that live in our area. And I think we work well together. And I just hope I would be able to inspire more of our younger generation females to work hard and serve their pueblo as well.
And something that I was thinking of when we were talking about doing this program and having, well, women leaders featured in the first look at Women's History Month, and related to it too, when we talk about journalism and being an Indigenous journalist, and people think that the story changes because of, you know, being an Indigenous person, that maybe you might do things differently because you're Indigenous and you won't look at the full story. And I always love to meet that challenge with saying, you do things honestly, no matter what. And so thinking about what being a leader is, and you are a female leader, you're a woman. Is there anything you'd like to share too about your views on that, of people who think things change, or is a leader a leader?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think anything changes. You know, as a leader, I still want to, you know, make sure that we grow in our pueblo, that we continue to offer our tribal members the opportunity to go to college, to get educated, you know, take, you know, any of our families that may be struggling, you know, get them out of poverty. You know, I think we have the same concerns as anyone else for our people, and being a female doesn't change any of that. You know, we wish the best. We want our people educated. We want our you know, people employed, housed, you know, everything that other communities struggle with. We fight for the same for our own people as well. You know, I don't see us doing anything different in our tribes or in our pueblos.
Sure. And the elements of good leadership, you know, they go across genders. We got to wrap things up here. And Governor Roy Ball, anything you want to leave us with, or other people who are just in your list of influences? Got about a minute. Go ahead.
Just continue to work hard for what you want, your dream. You know, you'll accomplish it. That's all I want to tell all the, especially the females out there who may be working hard for something. You know, don't stop. Just continue, and it'll pay off in the end. You know, I'm humbled to be where I'm at, and I dreamed of it. I didn't know it would happen, you know, or not, but I am obviously feel I've worked hard and accomplished my dream.
Well, thank you for that, Governor Roy Ball. We wish you a lot of strength stepping into this role, and look forward to visiting with you again down the road in the future. That's going to wrap it up for our program today. Thank you for tuning in. And if you missed anything, you can always find this program in our archives on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. Thank you again, Governor Janelle Roy Ball. Also, thank you to Kimberly Teehee and also Kaihulani Mahuka for joining us today. And we hope you'll join us again tomorrow for a discussion about change in Canada brought on by Indigenous people. It's Monday. We're starting off the week. There are other programs we hope you'll join us for. Get all the details on our website, NativeAmericaCalling.com. And if you have more people to add to our thoughts of who to be looking at when we talk about the history of Native women, reach out, find us on Facebook or on our website. I'm Tara Gatewood.
Support by Amerind, Indian Country's 100% tribally owned insurance partner. Amerind works with tribal governments and their business enterprises to provide effective commercial insurance coverage, strengthen Native American communities, protect tribal sovereignty, and help keep dollars in Indian Country. More information on property, liability, workers' compensation, and commercial auto solutions at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Osio, Ayela Nudana Dega, Gutla Ulskedi, Nogu, Sina Tigesai, Udlana da Nautic, Gohuelo di Dodoa, Marketplace Gutla, Unskerdi, Hiskatu Iyikohida, Tetlanoheta Niawia, Ayela Nudana Dega, and Access Diski, Naski Yiged Stella, at healthcare.gov, 1-800-318-2596, He are getting osa Medicare, Ala Medicaid Unadalka.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite Service. Music is by Brent Michael Davis. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.